Good morning, everyone. Am I loud and clear at the back?
Yes.
Good. Great. I'm very tired. I've had a hard week. I've been at the Christian Resources Exhibition all week with a few people here. And I've been waking up at 4 o'clock every morning. I just can't sleep. Just so excited, you know. In the end, I've actually got out of bed at 5 in the morning and then I had to go to Esher and be there at 8 and, you know, long days, and I thought fall asleep in front of the telly in the evening, and I thought at least this morning, you know, I'll be able to have a decent night's sleep, you know, last night. But of course, I woke up at 5, and that was it. I'm up, so it's almost time for bedtime. So I'll try to squeeze these talks out before I fall asleep. But anyway, I must say the exhibition, there was a lot of interest for the book, more than I actually had realised before. So I get to realise there is a bit of a responsibility for me to promote this book, which is something I hadn't really done for any of my other books. So, please pray that the book finds. We haven't got a distributor yet. Even the publisher it's been self-published because my last publisher didn't really promote any of my other books. So I've gone my own way. But of course, if a big publisher comes along and offers a deal, then I'll go for it. But so just pray if you feel the book needs to be out there, and I suppose these talks may convince you one way or another. Anyway, so this is going to be a two-parter. So the first part, which should be about approximately half an hour, is the first half. It's talking about the problem in the church, and the second talk will be the solution for the church. And the sort of subtitle for the first one is The Stubborn Stains of Greece. Okay, Greece spelt G-R-E-E-C-E, so just in case. Okay, the year is 397 BC. Something happened in that year when the final words of the Old Testament were written. In the book I called it God's gap year, because it seemed like God had disappeared for like 400 years. And what happened was like this 400-year silence from the heavens, until God opened the book of the New Testament and instructed Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, to appear to Zechariah in the temple. But until then, for 400 years, there'd been no university-accepted Holy Scripture, no prophecy or divine visitations for these 4 centuries. So what did happen in those 4 centuries was very, very significant. It was like the devil seized the moment to act, taking God's apparent leave of absence. As a license to cause mischief. So the devil, I believe, was very, you know, operating in a strong way during those 4 centuries. And what we need to do is focus on that one year. That year when Malachi, the last great prophet, sort of moved, you know, sort of his, that was the end, you know, the end of his utterances. It's 397 BC. In that time, there was Artaxerxes II was ruling the Persian Empire. The Romans were building their republic. The Carthaginians were suffering defeats. King An of Zhou was bossing China. And in Athens, Socrates, the first great philosopher of the modern age, was nearing the end of his controversial but influential life. So Socrates, this is where we go to next, because the spotlight in those gap years of God, these days of silence, the focus goes from Israel to Greece. Because around that time, there was an awful lot of very clever and capable people who had appeared on the scene. People who thought very long and hard about the world around them and what made it tick. These were the philosophers, and although they had already been around for a couple of centuries before Socrates, the stage had been prepared and set for the drama to come. Socrates, take your bow. Here he is. Enter stage left, an ugly little bloke in flowing robes. He stands there under the glare of the lights, blinking awkwardly, but unbowed. Socrates, why were you so significant? You'll have to ask others. I couldn't possibly comment. That's him talking. All right. Enter stage right, Plato. Taller, younger, more dignified, and lost. Oh, there he is. Yes, Plato. Taller, younger, more dignified. Right, this is Plato speaking. I'll speak up for Socrates. He's my teacher, my inspiration. In fact, all my early work features the man himself in dialogue with others. Socrates allows Plato to speak up for him. And Plato speaks. Before my learned teacher entered the scene, we philosophers concerned ourselves with the world around us. Is the world made up of earth, air, fire and water? Or are there smaller building blocks? Does mathematics govern everything? What about poetry? Well, Socrates changed all that. What he did, he taught us to look within at our moral beings, at what makes us tick. So Socrates was indeed influential. Yeah, Plato can disappear for a bit. We haven't rehearsed this. Right, Socrates was indeed influential, even for modern-day thinkers. So key was he that all who preceded him were lumped together in a single classification. They were called the pre-Socratics. They were like the warm-up acts. Anyway, Socrates was a familiar figure in the streets of Athens. He was an effective teacher. His classrooms were the public spaces. His pupils were taken from the rich young men of his day, with time on their hands and rebellion in their hearts. He taught them logic and the ability to reason. On the positive side, one effect of this teaching was the jettisoning of the sorry, pathetic load of Greek gods, like, you know, the Zeus and the Aphrodites. You know, he spoke against them. But unfortunately, that led to his downfall, because not so positive for him was that he was condemned to death by the repressive city government for corrupting the young and also neglecting the gods. So goodbye, Socrates, you're dead now. Take a last bow. Right. Plato. There he comes. Now, he was Socrates' disciple. He was his biographer and recorded his ideas and became in his own right perhaps the most influential of Socrates' pupils. He founded a school in Academia, the suburb of Athens, the very first academy, so Academia Academy. There people were instructed in mathematics, geometry, law and the natural sciences and philosophy. He also wrote much, but much of his early writings were based on the ideas of Socrates, who wrote no books himself. All right, so now for something important, so the first important thing. Plato never realised it, but his ideas were to become almost as influential as Jesus in the development of Western Christianity. So that's the first sort of blockbuster there. Plato didn't realise it, but his ideas were to become almost as influential as Jesus in the development of Western Christianity. He said a lot of stuff, he wrote a lot of stuff, but his one big idea is what we're going to focus on, because this was going to become a tiny seed that got into the fertile soil of early Christianity and grew and grew and grew until, you'll have to wait and see. His big idea was called the theory of forms. And here's the story. We tend to label these sort of Greek thinkers as sort of giants, you know, brainy giants, masters of thought and reason, defenders of logic. We expect them to think through all sorts of matters of the inner world of the mind and the body in terms of the natural world, in terms of what can be seen, heard and perceived by the senses. But actually, that's not quite true for this man, Plato. Plato was a man of ideas, but thought little of the world that surrounded him. He believed that there were two worlds. The obvious one is the one that we live in, and a perfect one somewhere else in the universe. I suppose this would be his concept of heaven, this sort of, you know, world out there somewhere. And in this heaven exists what Plato calls forms, in his perfect heaven, perfect universe. To understand what he means by this, we have to think about everything that we see around us, from objects like chairs, diamonds, or Norman, who's fallen asleep. Common everyday objects. And actually, this is also about Norman. Also, concepts like beauty and goodness. Maybe that's your wife. Or maybe not. Right. Now, you must realise that according to Plato, all of these things in our world are imperfect copies. So what we see when we look at that chair, when we look at Norman, these are imperfect copies of a Norman that's existed in this other ideal universe. So these items of perfection in this other universe are his forms, Plato's forms. So that's the first thing to get your head around. Plato thought that everything in our universe was just imperfect copies of stuff that's in this perfect universe. Plato also believed that whereas most of us would never get to see these forms, some of us would, and these are the guardians. They call them the guardians or the philosophers, gifted and trained individuals. And he explained all this in his analogy of the cave, which is a bit complicated, but I sort of summarised it. In the analogy of the cave, he says, our lives are as prisoners deep inside a cave, where all we can see of objects are their shadows projected on the wall by a fire. We believe that what we see is reality, but we are mistaken. To see really, we have to leave the cave and to see things how they really are outside the cave. So most of us here, we live in the cave and all we're seeing is shadows, sort of reflections of the perfect. And according to Plato, the person who leaves the cave, who makes the step to leave the cave, he is the guardian. And he is rewarded by viewing the higher good, the source of all truth and reason. So here's an idea that seems vaguely Christian. So perhaps here's the first clue as to how on earth this idea managed to find a home in the early development of Christianity. So this brings us to God, because this higher good of Plato, he says it's the ultimate form, the top of the forms, his concept of God. But it's not the God that we know. This is important. This is not our personal God. This higher good is what we must aspire to, according to Plato. The higher good is an eternal reality that exists in this higher realm. And our physical senses are just not equipped to actually see this higher good any more than just a pale reflection. So, to sort of summarise that little idea, there's Plato's concept of God is an impersonal one in Plato's philosophy. His God does not answer prayers, it doesn't comfort those in distress or teach the people or listen to the cries of the heart. His God is definitely not our Father in heaven, and that's very important to know, very important. Plato believed that there are absolute standards for such things as goodness, morality and truth. Each of these are sort of in a perfect state in this other world. He also believed in the eternal soul. So, what is the problem with Plato? Well, it now starts to go downhill. When he starts thinking about the body and the soul, because he believed that every person is a body and a soul, and he believed that they are totally separate, the body and the soul. And only during our lifetime are they all put together temporarily. And this was a concept known as duality. This came from Plato, and this is what we're going to sort of see Christianity got hold of. And that's when things started to go very wrong. So to Plato, the soul was a dominant, superior entity. It's immortal, being reborn again and again in different bodies, gaining in knowledge as it does. So like the concept of reincarnation. So really, Plato's idea of the soul is just like Eastern philosophies, like Hindu, the idea of your soul just leaves your body and then ends up in someone else's body and goes on and on and on. It says the soul is our seat of thought and knowledge, associated with this perfect world that we talked about earlier. And to Plato, the body is what's in our imperfect world, you know, the world that we live in, and the body interacts through the five senses, restricting the soul from attaining its full potential. So to Plato, the body sort of gets in the way of the soul. The body is bad, you know, the soul is good. So this is the first great concept. Everything associated with the soul is good, and the body is bad. This is Plato. Soul is good, body bad. Fixes. This is the big consequence of Plato's big idea. Soul is good, body is bad. So, to summarise then, we had the closing of the Old Testament. We had these four centuries when God seemed to be silent. God's gap year, where all these new ideas were coming out of Greece. And we will now start to see the relevance of this, because these ideas and ideals are not just going to impact the world, but also the church. It's interesting that I don't know if any of you have been to the Vatican, but in this the Apostolic Palace in the Vatican, there's a painting by Raphael. It's known as the School of Athens, and features a whole load of Greek philosophers. And clearly seen are Plato and Aristotle, a later one, in conversation. Plato is pointing up above to the heavens, and Aristotle's pointing down to the earth. The question we need to ask is, why on earth are they in the centre of Christianity, these Greek philosophers? That's interesting. So that brings us to the church. Now, the church, as we know it, didn't just pop out of nowhere. It's today's... Oh, by the way, you can go. Yeah, say goodbye, Plato. Off you go. Right, the church, as we know it, didn't just pop out of nowhere. It's today's snapshot of a continuous historic process that started effectively when the Holy Spirit came down on that small group in Jerusalem a few weeks after the resurrection. Now, for a body, the church, whose chief mandate is to gather people of all backgrounds and cultures into its fold, staying pure and unsullied while it focused on its received mission, this was always going to be an issue. Now, contrast this with Israel, okay, in the Old Testament. Now, Israel's mandate was to stay pure and holy, you know, separate, by living a separate existence from the world that surrounded them, by living through this wall of regulations, the Torah, given to God by Moses. Israel was equipped to remain unsullied by the pagan nations that surrounded them. But they failed. You know, even with all the restrictions of the Torah and everything, you know, God giving them revelation, they still failed. So they got seduced by the rival gods, prostituted themselves to alien lifestyles. But their failure wasn't a total one, thank goodness, because the messianic bloodline was protected and Jesus came. And, you know, and that was through the Jewish people. The point we're making here is that here we have a nation, Israel, socially engineered by God to remain pure and untouched, but still fails to remain so, thanks to the human heart, thanks to the sin in everyone, not just the Jewish people. How much more so will another group, the Christians, whose very reason for existence is to reach the world, become tainted in order to in turn, by the very people it's trying to reach? So if Israel was engineered to stay pure and yet failed, how is a church going to fare? How can the church remain pure? Well, unfortunately, it didn't. And this tainting began fairly soon after we read about the council in Jerusalem in Acts 15, where we have, you know, the church was Jewish. And then what do we do about these Gentiles? There's all these Gentiles floating around. And what do we do about them? You know, do they become Jewish? Do we care about them? You know, we, in my view, we should have kept them out there. But, you know, there's a few people nodding. But we blame that on the Greeks. But what happened just two chapters after that question was posed by the Jewish leadership, we have Paul himself going to... Paul, yes, let's talk about Paul. Paul, there he comes. You might recognise him as Mordecai from Purim. Man of many talents, many gifts. So I'm reading from Acts 17. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though it is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your poets have said, we are his offspring." So this is Paul addressing the Greeks, understanding that there are other cultures out there, and, you know, what are we going to do about them? And this meeting place is Areopagus. It's also translated as Mars Hill. And it's interesting to notice this is a name adopted by two key churches now in the USA who are attempting to interface with the culture of the day. Now, this is what Paul was doing in Acts 17, but little did he know that about a century later, the floodgates would have been opened and the Hebrew faith in Jesus the Messiah was going to be thoroughly swamped by the Greek culture of this day. So within a century of at the end of the book of Acts, the Hebrew faith in Jesus the Messiah was going to be thoroughly swamped by the Greek culture of the day. And it all started with Plato. So let's see Plato again and... Do you remember Haman?
Yeah.
What did we do with Haman? Right, come on.
Boo. Paul. Plato.
Right, okay.
Right, Paul can go.
Right, it all started with Plato. He was so key to everything in the 20th century that the philosopher A.N. Whitehead suggested that all of Western philosophy ultimately consists of no more than footnotes to Plato. But it's the church we're interested in. So what happens with the church? Now, Plato, he founded a seat of learning in Athens. It's the Academy, which continued after he died, ensuring that his philosophy, known as Platonism, flourished. When Christianity spread westward from Jerusalem to the lands to the east, it was Platonism that was encountered first. The early church fathers had to make a decision. And this is pretty key, because the whole history is sort of balances on this decision. And the church had to say this: do we ignore the culture around us? Do we engage with it, or do we learn from it? It seems what the church did with Platonism is engage. As with Paul in the Areopagus earlier, the best way forwards at that time, the church fathers took it actually further than that. Trained in Greek thought, they saw no danger in constructing a Christian worldview in the light of the teachings of Plato. They felt they could merge the two together. One of these teachers, Justin Martyr, had the view that Platonists would be so challenged by the similarities between their worldview and Christianity that they may consider conversion, not realising that, you know, there's a different God involved in each. It seemed that what may have started as engagement for the purposes of evangelism swiftly gave way to debate, then compromise, then assimilation. And it was the Christianity that lost the battle. Christianity, from that point onwards, virtually became a subdivision of Platonism with added grace. But Platonism became very much at the heart of Christianity. So how could this happen? Well, actually, it started with the Jews. In fact, one Jew, his name, I haven't got, no, we won't pretend that suddenly Paul has become Philo. But Philo is the name of this Jew living in Alexandria in Egypt, which was one of the most famous cities at the time. And this was just after the time of Jesus. Now, Philo may have been a Jew, but his education... Plato can go now, by the way. Off you go. Bye. Philo may have been a Jew, but his education was thoroughly Greek, in common with all Jews living in Egypt. Yet he was a loyal and proud Jew, and his life's ambition was to bring together his religious heritage, his Judaism, with his philosophy from Greece. He believed he saw continuity between Moses and Plato. And the problem of his day was that many Jews trained in Greek ways were rejecting Moses and rejecting the Bible. So Philo worked hard to create a compromise that would be acceptable. His main work was in the creation of Bible commentaries, mainly of the book of Genesis. And he was the first to do so with one figure in the pages of the Bible, one finger in the pages of the Bible, and the other in the works of Plato. For instance, the creation story. To Plato and to Philo, the universe came into being through the work of an entity called the Demiurge. Not quite God as we know it, but a sort of a lesser God. Now remember what we said earlier, Plato's big consequence, that soul is good and the body is bad, this concept of dualism. This can be simplified further, saying that everything of the physical world is inferior to everything in the spiritual world. And that's what, again, what Plato believed. So this Demiurge, this God who created the whole world, has to be an inferior God, according to Plato. So this is where we get the idea of the Old Testament a little bit inferior to the New Testament. The consequence of the Demiurge is the concept of the Demiurge is a consequence of Platonism. It's a fudge to support a faulty philosophy. And that is the problem if your starting point is faltered. Everything that follows after it is also false, and you're just going to be sinking further and further. This is even the case with techniques used to implement your ideas. Now, the technique that Philo used when he looked at the books of Moses, it's the same one already used in the book when they looked at the Greek texts, such as the works of Homer. And this tool is known as allegory. And the damage that it did to the Bible text is extreme. And allegory, so it's worth just sort of understanding what allegory actually is. It's key, so it's worth labouring the point. It's defined as a way of representing a situation, giving it a meaning that is not a literal meaning. And I'll do some examples to explain this. You've all read Animal Farm, George Orwell. So what's that all about? Animals in a farm. But it was an allegory. Okay, so George Orwell did it as an allegory of the Soviet era of Stalin in pre-war years. So whereas the kids may have a hate figure in Napoleon the Pig, there's a greater hate figure implied in Stalin. So, you know, the kids saw Napoleon the Pig, adults saw Stalin. So if we take the story literally, it's the story of talking animals, but allegorically, it's a political satire. We've got the Wizard of Oz is another example. Gave a lot of joy to a generation of kids, exercised the brains of a generation of scholars and commentators who saw allegory all over the place of it. So in its literal sense, it's just a good yarn. But as an allegory, it can be seen, one of the things is economists see it as a critique of the gold standard, which is a little bit complicated, and I won't explain that because I don't understand it, but just shows you, got to be honest. So one big question we have to ask is whether the author intended to create an allegory. And if so, what point is he making? Because in George Orwell's case, the allegory was clear and unambiguous. With The Wizard of Oz, the author, Frank Baum, never made it clear what the real meaning of the movie was. So, moving on, what about the Bible? Well, we know the author, God himself. So when Philo went through the text of the Old Testament, he had to be sure that if he saw allegory, then God had to be in agreement. And if he wasn't, then he was on dangerous ground indeed. So it's one thing Philo seeing allegory, but if God didn't, you know, intend allegory to be there, then we're coming into very, very dangerous areas. So why would Philo have to use allegory? And what's it got to do with Plato? Well, it's this, again, it's this dualism. So it's worth delving deeper into this dualism to extract the core thinking behind it. So again, Plato, he says the soul is good, body is bad. He's declaring there a very, very basic principle in religious terms. He's saying that the physical world in which we live, all this world around us, is bad or evil. And the spiritual world, heaven, is good and therefore worth striving for. So, material world bad, spiritual world good. This theme is going to pop up again and again as you begin to realise how this has begun to this sunk into the minds of the church through the whole of history. Material world bad, spiritual world good. Because of this, Philo was very uncomfortable. Whenever in the Bible he saw God mixing it with the humans on the material world, he and using sort of emotions when God sort of seems sort of getting down to people and talking to them, you'd expect Philo was very uncomfortable. You'd think he'd also be uncomfortable with Jesus. And it's interesting that their lifetimes overlapped. Perhaps they could even have met. When Philo wrote of such interactions between God and man, he couldn't figure out, you know, God is spiritual, man is physical. There's no way the two could go together. So any time that he saw that, he said, that's allegory. You know, that's not real. So he put allegory whenever he saw something that he saw as spiritual. So he began looking for spiritual meanings in the Bible, in a lot of cases in verses where God just meant them to be literal. So God wrote them as literal, but Philo had to see them as spiritual because that was what this Greek philosophy forced into him. So anyway, moving on, Philo is just a stepping stone because we move on another century and we now get into the church years. And the next major figure is someone called Origen. He was a Christian, he was a church father, and he also lived in Alexandria. In common with Philo, he wanted to interpret the Bible, but there was a major difference because although Philo looked to marry together the Jewish interpretations with his insights from Greek philosophy, he also always saw himself as a Jew first, Philo, and his writings reflected that fact. But with Origen was a Gentile Christian who was writing Bible commentaries for other Christians in the Greek world. For him, the Hebrew text and the Jewish themes were just raw material. He had, you know, no axe to grind for Jews. He didn't care what happened to the Jewish people. He just wanted to interpret, you know, the words of the Bible for a Gentile audience. And he was obviously Origen influenced by both Philo and Plato. But when he looked at the Bible, he went even further. Whereas Philo often gave literal and allegory interpretations, Origen tended to dwell on allegory alone. As a Christian heavily influenced by Plato, he saw the spiritual world everywhere in the Bible. And he even strained the text to find meanings, spiritual meanings, where obviously they weren't even meant to be there. And Origen, in fact, was responsible for making allegory the dominant form of Bible interpretation for centuries to come. So we can see the church has got this seed of Platonic, you know, from Plato into the church. And the way we look at the Bible has got to be absolutely key. But this is like one of the first points of real problems for the church, how you actually see the Bible be interpreted. And what Origen would do, he would reinterpret the Old Testament in the light of the New Testament, but with Greek philosophy thrown in. His driving principle was the Bible contained three levels of meaning, corresponding to the body, the soul, and the spirit. You can see how Plato was influencing here. And he said, as far as the body would represent the literal meaning, which had the lowest value, and the mind and the spirit had the highest value, because that was the spiritual way of looking at the Bible. So basically you can see, you know, it's starting to go wrong. And if Origen discerned that a Bible passage was speaking about Christ, then for him that had to be the only meaning of the text. He may have had the best of motives, but is it correct? You know, is it what God had in mind when he wrote the text to start on? So just moving on quickly. What's the time? What time am I finishing? Probably gone over. Oh, it's not much to go. Right. Those of you falling asleep, we'll be coming out of Greek philosophy very soon. But we just need to establish his context for part two, which will be a lot easier. Okay, our next port of call of this tour is a place also in Africa called Hippo, in modern-day Algeria. We're going to meet the man who can be described in two different ways, depending on your perspective. To both the Catholics and the Protestants, and the Protestant reformers, he's one of the most important figures in the development of Western Christianity. To others, he's a philosopher who mixed together Christian doctrine with Platonism. Like many of his church fathers, he was a sum of all his influences, a Christian philosopher, a term that should, by all rights, be an oxymoron, if you know what that means. Clever word. Yeah. Right? Christian, what I'm saying is two words that should never go together. Christian philosopher. His name was Augustine. You hear about, if you've got a Catholic background, then you know all about Augustine. He was enormously influential. We get the idea of original sin from Augustine and our understanding of evil. And he has contributed much. But it's worth looking at what was influencing him. His original follower of something called Manichaeism. Can you say that? There you go, Manichaeism. Which was a cult that was into dualism. Good versus evil, light versus darkness, body versus soul. So that was his background. It was more closer to Buddhism than Christianity. Then his main influence when he became a Christian was Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, who introduced him to the techniques of Philo and Origen, this idea of allegory. The fact that Augustine was so influential in the development of the Western Church, that if we perceive any issues in the way he interprets the Bible, then this is going to have great consequences. So, you know, so his take on such matters as allegory or literal, this is going to be crucial. The way he sees it is how the church was going to develop. So suffice to say, he just took from Plato to Origen, to Philo to Origen, and just carried on the same line. And that's how, for him, Bible text should be viewed. Although he was correct in declaring that scriptures are inspired of God, he reinforced Origen's ideas that Christ needs to be shoehorned all over the Old Testament, even where there's an uncomfortable fit, and that allegorical interpretations were given to passages that he was unsure about or unhappy. So anything that looked too down and dirty, too physical, let's put an allegory in there. And this, when we get to realise the idea of the idea of evolution versus creation, the idea of creation, that became an allegory, that couldn't have happened, it's just too much of God doing stuff on earth. And such thing. And Israel is another issue, and the Jews, the background of the Jews, we won't go into that. So his approach was, in the first instance, when you see a piece of text, you should say, what is the spirit behind the literal text? That's what Augustine would say. And then look, you know, originally just for spiritual interpretations rather than literal meanings. So we now set the scene. The scene has been set. Because of the demands of the Platonic worldview in preferring the spiritual over the material, spiritual meanings were sought, even in biblical passages that were obviously literal. And now free-for-all was created, allowing Christian teachers right up to the current day to be able to say anything they like. It's to bend Christian words of the Bible into any meaning they like, because God has given them, you know, a prophecy. You know, this is a spiritual interpretation. God meant it this way. I have a revelation. And that you see that a lot on television, you know, Christian TV, in a lot of places. It's getting worse and worse. But this is where it's come from. The idea that allegory, which is very subjective, can actually take the place of a literal meaning. And this is the legacy of the infiltration of Greek philosophy into Christian theology. The ideas of Plato, refined by Philo and Origen, became thoroughly entwined with God's revelation to us, thanks to Augustine, the father of the Western Church. So for the consequences of this, and there are many, you'll have to read the book. Part one of the book shows you the consequences of all this stuff. So the church has been thoroughly greased, and to paraphrase David Paulson, we need to thoroughly degrease the church to remove these stubborn stains. So for that, we'll stop now and we'll continue after a short break. Thank you.